This negativity spreads within the walls of the prisons, and when these inmates are eventually released, they go back into the community and spread their germs like a virus, which increases the problem tenfold. These are times of high violence and the greatest use of illegal drugs and alcohol in history, which our team described as being at crisis point. The conclusion drawn in spirit is that the only things governments are doing is increasing the size and number of jails. They wanted to make it clear that the urgent need is for internal change, and certainly not for the abolition of the prisons themselves. Certain people still have to be kept away from society, but it is the environment in which they are held that is the most important thing. The feeling in the afterlife is that society cannot expect to lock people away, as we do now, treat them like wild animals, and then expect to release them back into the community without proper rehabilitation. For example, when pedophiles eventually return to the afterlife, they are treated with extreme caution, as they are on Earth. John described pedophilia as an attack on the most vulnerable members of the community, virtually the actions of a bully. However, everything in the spirit world is a huge learning opportunity, and these spirits are placed in a special hospital environment. Although this is a separate area in the spirit world, it is not tantamount to being in jail. The emphasis is on healing and learning about the destructive path they led in their previous life. Interestingly, these spirits are not forcibly detained in any way. As John pointed out, you can't chain up a spirit. However, they know they cannot advance to the next level until they have understood how their last life deviated from its purpose, and learned to rectify their behavior in future lives. Recent media stories of pedophiles, particularly involving priests in many different countries, could easily be interpreted as an upsurge of pedophilia. Not so, according to those observing from the world of spirit. There have always been pedophiles, but there has been a surge in the way it is being reported. The electronic media is now so instantaneous and voracious that we get to hear about it more often. The current attitude by authorities on Earth is that when people are locked up, they will automatically learn their lesson. John equated this to a school teacher shutting a child in a room for an hour and then expecting that young person to have learned his or her lesson, something that rarely happens. The child is more likely to get angry and to rebel instead. Given that good spirits cannot enter the prisons because they are virtually locked out, what is the solution? Change has to start with those in control of the prison system. John maintained that if prisoners are given one-on-one guidance, together with nurturing, and are encouraged to practice things such as meditation, the problems would start to resolve. It comes down to the people in charge and the way the system is run. The changes needed are so widespread that a whole new structure will have to be put in place. However, the main problem is that governments will not make these changes because they are not politically expedient. A survey released by the BBC at the time of the writing of this book revealed that there were approximately 9 million people held in prisons around the world, with half of them located in the United States, China, and Russia. In India, where meditation is a universally accepted practice in both the Hindu and Buddhist faiths, the number of prisoners at 30 per 100,000 of total population is the lowest percentage recorded in the world. Coincidence? Perhaps, but worth investigation. In the prison system, everything is done for the easiest and most convenient path possible for those in authority, but ironically ends up costing the government more money in the long term. The other impediment to change in the prison system is the widespread community attitude that people need to be punished for their misdeeds, so why should we want to nurture them? Spirits in the afterlife can identify these problems and express their concern, but it is still up to the world community to recognize the long-term benefits these changes will have and force governments to act. As the situation is worsening each year, it may take a new generation of reformers, perhaps recently born or even yet to reincarnate, to provide that inspiration. 53, TV in the afterlife. Several subjects popped up from time to time in the many sessions we had with John and his spirit team. Some of this information produced a laugh, or even an unexpected revelation about our life on the other side. On one occasion, John casually mentioned something about people in the spirit world keeping up with world events by tuning into television. I quickly jumped on that one with all sorts of images flashing through my mind. Now, lest you think that spirits loll around drinking beer and watching their favorite soap operas, or playing video games, let me point out that TV viewing, like most activities in the afterlife, has a purpose. John revealed that spirits sometimes try to exert a subtle influence on our television coverage, particularly for important events, when politicians are preparing and making their speeches. Spirits are there, doing their best to help get the right message across. This positive influence has been made more difficult in recent years with the bitter hatred that has become evident in politics in many countries. Verbal abuse has become common, and recently physical assaults and all-in brawls have occurred in the heated debates of some parliaments. Wondering whether my living room would sometimes be overcrowded with invisible viewers, I asked if spirits have to return to Earth to watch TV. Do they have their own television sets in the afterlife? The ultimate smart TV? It turns out there is no technology required, as spirits are able to tune in directly by using what John described as a thought process. This practice is also frequently used as a part of group learning in the afterlife, when the teacher wishes to emphasize a point using visual means, similar to what we on Earth would see in a training session or seminar. John said the best way he can describe this ability is very much like closing your eyes and picturing a television screen in your mind's eye, featuring a story from the last news program you watched. A spirit is able to project these images to others from their memory banks, either as a hologram or directly into their individual thoughts. It sounds very much like science fiction, but, according to John, people on Earth will be able to do the same in the not-too-distant future as part of other amazing mind creations. This will be part of the evolution of humans as we move out of the restrictions of three-dimensional reality into higher realms. There are already people on Earth capable of these feats, and when the time is right they will pass on their knowledge to the rest of humanity. 54. Reincarnation. Reincarnation has always made sense to me, and even as a child I intuitively knew I had lived many lives before this one. I have a straightforward attitude to this subject. Why would we have only one chance at life as a human being in such a complex world? We live in a well-ordered universe subject to many cycles, planetary, seasonal, and organic, where life is far from random. It is not logical to my mind that some people can be born to affluence while millions exist in abject poverty. Is it just the luck of the draw that some people live a long and happy life while others die after a short or miserable existence? Is it just survival of the fittest? Dog eat dog? I find it more logical that, as supposedly the highest developed life forms on this planet, we are given more than one opportunity, enabling us to experience many aspects of life here. Otherwise, what is the purpose of it all? There is plenty of evidence for reincarnation, as I believe this book and my previous book among others document, and I do not intend to go into any further philosophical discussion here. However, there are two questions I have been frequently asked during talks and in readings when the subject of reincarnation arises. Over to John and Team Spirit for the answers. Firstly, with more than 7 billion people on Earth now, are spirits being recycled quicker than in past ages? John's reply was short and to the point. No, definitely not. Judy's earlier explanation, documented in Chapter 38, of souls fragmenting in the afterlife to create new life, provides a more comprehensive answer to this question. The second question is, how long do we usually spend in the afterlife before reincarnating? This will depend on our individual circumstances, with the understanding that there is no such thing as time in the world of spirit. When our guides and elders consider us ready for another life, we will be offered the right opportunity. There are many threads to weave when life contracts are created by the elders, involving the people and situations we will be working with in our next incarnation. There is no point in rushing back to another body if those people we most need to interact with are not going to be there at the same time. When you stop to think about it, Our life contracts are so complicated, with so many potential directions and variables involved. The question of when and where we reincarnate is very complex. There are specialist spirits in the afterlife who put all these threads in place so that each life opportunity will not be wasted. It is rather like organizing an international event like the Olympic Games and not giving it enough planning and preparation. When the opening ceremony gets underway, the host country may suddenly realize it has forgotten to officially invite a few key nations. It also may not have had enough time to build a swimming pavilion. Oops. However, there are some spirits that do reincarnate quickly because they have an important role or purpose to fulfill. John refers to these people as spiritual soldiers. Their job is to enter a body, carry out the required duties, leave, and then quickly reincarnate to continue their work. Generally speaking, though, there is no rush for a spirit to reincarnate. 55, Full Circle. As my exploration into the heaven world drew to a close, my guide M contacted me in the dream state, suggesting that it would be most fitting to go full circle from where I started. When I woke the next morning and remembered the dream, my mind automatically went back to the time spent with Ruth Phillips, née Wilson, who made the original connection with Judy in spirit a few months after she passed over in 1997. Ruth not only put the two of us back in contact again, but also told me I had been given permission by spirit to develop my own abilities as a medium so that I could maintain contact with Judy. I had always been fascinated by the thought of communicating with people on the other side, and had occasionally enjoyed this by consulting other mediums. Even though I had been working as a clairvoyant and astrologer, it did not mean I was also able to automatically communicate with people in the afterlife. Mediumship is a very special ability. Uncovering this talent was slow work for me at first, but because I had a strong intention to communicate with Judy, I gradually started to open up to her and to the heaven world. At first we were able to communicate quite well in group situations, as I now realize that I needed other people's energy to maintain contact. Judy would often round up spirits to be present in my spiritual development groups, and I soon dubbed her my spirit wrangler. Eventually I learned how to achieve brief one-on-one communication with her, and Judy helped me open my mind to contact spirits when I was doing psychic consultations. When I contacted Ruth, she was only too pleased to speak to Judy for me, even though they had not been in contact since 1997, and insisted that she would not read Afterlife beforehand. Ruth had read and approved only the chapter in which she was featured, and had no idea of the overall content of the book. Before speaking with Ruth, I did a morning session of yoga and then contacted my guide M to check that the lines of communication were open and clear. M confirmed that Judy was ready and waiting, along with John and his team as backup, and he, too, would oversee it. I realized then the importance that was being placed on this connection. Judy came through easily to Ruth, who described her as having such a beautiful energy and with a big smile on her face. Ruth had met Judy only once, briefly, just before she passed over in 1997, so I am sure Judy's face was not etched on her mind. One of Judy's great features was a smile that lit up her whole face, but because she was exhausted and very close to passing when Ruth met her, that smile was rarely in evidence. Judy's first message was that this is her swan song, which made Ruth's presence so meaningful. Judy went on to say that this book completes the circle with her direct energy involved, and the next books that I write will be directed by what she termed higher frequencies. Judy said her inspiration and mentorship are coming to a close and our contact will be less frequent from now on, as she is progressing to another level in the afterlife. This means that her soul vibration will be increasing to a higher frequency, making it harder for her to come back to communicate in Earth's denser levels. Judy says that the two books we worked on together were as much for her own development as mine, but now I will no longer have need for her input. I am well past the stage where I need proof of survival and I don't need to be in regular contact with her. I had mixed feelings about this news, On one hand, I was happy for Judy's soul to be advancing to new levels, while on the other I was sad at the thought of having much less contact with her. Ruth was shown a vision of a lovely crystal orb symbolizing this completion phase, which she described as having a beautiful energy. Ruth experienced a sense of peace and love at this point, which she described as most gratifying. Judy went on to give me some valuable advice about future books that I will be writing and encouragement for some other intriguing projects on the long road ahead, and informed me that there is still much work to do. After Judy said her farewell, Ruth was told by her own guides that she and I had wandered in and out of each other's lives over many incarnations. Ruth was shown an image of us working together as fellow druids and bards in an ancient Celtic past life, one which she described as very meaningful. Ah, but that is another story. Afterward. The wonderful thing writing about the afterlife and our past lives is that new information keeps pouring in. After completing this book, I received an intriguing message from Bob Murray in Canada. Bob is a highly respected medium and also the author of The Stars Still Shine, which chronicles the afterlife journey of his son-in-law Michael. Bob is a regular guest on Radio Out There, and in our off-air chats he often mentions that we have a strong past life connection. Bob contacted me out of the blue to let me know about a very vivid past life connection he had experienced, involving us both in the US Civil War. When Bob sent me his story, I was fascinated, as I have always known of a past life at this time, and have a long-standing interest in the Civil War. I have shared this information with only a couple of people, one of whom was my late partner, Judy, who was also a part of that life. Bob had no idea of this past life, let alone that I had fought with the Southern Confederate Army, and was killed in a bloody battle. Bob has kindly given permission to recount his story. The year was 1863, and two Englishmen, William Heath, now Robert Murray, and Reginald Cosgrove, now Barry Eaton, volunteered to go to the Confederate States of America on a buying trip. The mills of England needed raw cotton to continue production, but the American Civil War was raging. The Northern forces had created an embargo on the South, and British ships were not allowed in or out. William and Reginald were sent over to find a way around the blockade. They first traveled to the West Indies, then by small coaster to some islands off the coast of North Carolina. From there, they were smuggled to the mainland and Richmond, the capital of the Confederacy. Supplies in the way of war material were smuggled in, but nothing was going out. The two men soon realized that cotton was not being grown and existing stores were in critically short supply. Nothing was available for export, even if they could get through the blockade. Both men were excellent horsemen and had served in a cavalry unit in England. They hadn't seen battle but were well trained. When they arrived, the decimated cavalry units were in the western part of the war zone, with very few remounts left. William and Reginald had limited choices: go back to England via the smuggler's route, or stay where they were. They decided to stay and volunteer their services to the Confederate Army. After several months of inaction and frustration, they both were given the honorary rank of colonel by General Robert E. Lee himself. He also swore them in as citizens of the Confederate States of America. It seems General Lee expected these new recruits to remain behind the lines and keep the many war widows comforted. They had other plans. With the gold they had brought with them, they bought clothing, boots, hats, gloves, revolvers, long guns, and ammunition. They tore off any gold braid and any distinguishing bits of clothing that would identify them as officers or even soldiers. They kept their identity papers as British newspaper recorders, not reporters in those days. They gave their new citizenship papers to a bartender at the hotel where they were staying, swearing him to secrecy and ordering him to keep them safe. In late June 1864, they took the supperly train to Petersburg, Virginia. Once at the lines, the two men proved to be very useful. The third day at the front, William led a 7-man patrol behind enemy lines and managed to disrupt some northern supply lines and create havoc when he torched a barn. He brought all his men back safely. Reginald, meanwhile, spoke with engineers about defensive positions and lines of fire. While William was leading the patrol, Reginald was organizing marksmen, or snipers, as they are called today. He wanted to lead night raiders but never got any volunteers. William and Reginald slept in the trenches with the men as the Siege of Petersburg turned into trench warfare. Both were badly wounded on July 14, 1864, when a mortar shell landed in the trench. However, they recovered from their wounds and went on for almost another miserable year. On a spring day, April 2, 1865, at 8:15 in the morning, they were killed. I decided to do a little research of my own, and discovered that the Third Battle of Petersburg started on April 2, 1865, and after a 10-month siege the Confederate forces were finally defeated by a superior force under General Ulysses S. Grant. A week later General Robert E. Lee surrendered, and the war was virtually over. Bob Murray received some further information a few weeks later, when he connected with a powerful spirit in the Akashic Records section of the afterlife. The spirit, calling himself Smith, spoke about the importance of working with emotion when exploring past lives. Bob provided me with a transcript of their contact. Smith, sometimes emotion is the way into the past life. In your time in Virginia during the Civil War, you and your friend Barry were filled with all kinds of emotion or you would have died old men back in England. Bob, would you explain what you mean? Smith, you went to the South to see if you could get cotton for the mills back in England. You wanted to break the blockade, but cotton was scarce. It was wartime and the Southerners just weren't growing cotton. No cotton and no exports. You then had a choice. Bob, yes, we could go back to England or stay. We chose to stay. Smith, that was an emotional decision because you met some Southern belles. Bob, and we stayed because of the women? Smith, partly. Everybody tried to put on a noble front, a brave front, and there was plenty of emotion going around. You two were willing to sit out the war in the bars and taverns of Richmond, but the two sisters you were seeing had a brother in Lee's army. He escaped from a Yankee prison and was brought back to Richmond, more dead than alive. When you first saw him, he was an emaciated skeleton with weeping sores and gaping wounds. He died shortly after he told you horror stories about the Yankees and what they did to prisoners. Bob, so we up and enlisted for the Confederate cause? Smith, not right then. You comforted the women but still didn't see the need to seek revenge for the loss of their brother. It was tragic, to be sure, but many others on both sides were being killed by the thousands. The South was losing men they couldn't replace, whereas the North was losing men but had replacements. It was a war of attrition, and the South was losing. Lee knew that he couldn't win in any conventional way but wanted to influence the Northern public in such a way that they would get tired of the war and sue for peace or at least a stalemate. You two met General Lee and he changed your minds. Bob, I think he gave us citizenship and ranks in the Confederate Army. Smith, it was honorary, but it impressed you. That part didn't change your mind, but what he told you did. Lee did not want his army to be in a siege. He knew that a mobile army couldn't be easily pinned down and could bring the fight to the enemy. He talked strategy with you because you and Barry were trained British cavalry officers. You agreed with his thinking and offered to help. Bob, I don't think we helped all that much. Smith, ah, but you did. You two saved many lives with your strategic tactics. Once the siege was laid, you and Barry used your engineering skills to build wicker willow baskets to contain the soil along the trenches. You both helped build tunnels, led raids, and kept supply lines going. Bob, but we couldn't save the South. Smith, of course not. Nobody could, not even in the early stages of the war. The industrial might of the North won over the agricultural South. Oh. At first the South seemed to be holding its own because of the inept handling of the Northern armies by politically appointed generals. When Sherman took over, it was the beginning of the end for the South. Bob, no glory in getting ourselves blown up by a gigantic mortar shell. Smith, none whatsoever. By then you were very emotionally involved with your fellow soldiers. They were your comrades in arms. They laid down their lives for you and you did the same for them. To put it very mildly, all wars are a stupid waste of people and animals, but they do bring out the best of man in the worst of times. It also brings out the worst of man in the best of times. Bob, so what did we learn, if anything? Are we better humans for that life? Are we more compassionate with our fellow humans? Smith, what do you think? I think you are, both of you. The end. One can follow the text Viaduct online book at https://archive.org/details/and-a-goodbye/cho-o-o-o-auto/page/n3/mode/2up.